Welcome to Cannabis House Call. This podcast is committed to educating the discerning public and will make the case for cannabis as medicine. Your hosts, Dr. Les Matthews and Dr. Hal Altman, are physicians with advanced degrees in medical cannabis. The Cannabis House Call is sponsored by Compassionate Certification Centers, or CCC. CCC is a physician-owned and leading medical marijuana certification center that helps patients receive legal access to medical marijuana in Pennsylvania. Having certified more than 100,000 patients across the state through its in-office and virtual telehealth appointments, CCC makes the process of getting a Pennsylvania medical marijuana card fast and easy. Learn more at cccregister.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Cannabis House Call. My name is Dr. Les Matthews, and I'm joined with my colleague, Dr. Hal Altman. We are both physicians with advanced degrees in medical cannabis and joined together to produce this podcast on a weekly basis to try to help the public become better informed about all things cannabis. Welcome, Hal. It's good to be back with you.
Thank you, Les. Good to be with you and the listening audience. I think our task today is to talk in depth about THC, which is the probably most famous ingredient in cannabis. We have already talked a little bit about the history of cannabis as medicine. We've talked about the political and cultural impacts of the 20th century on cannabis as medicine. We have covered the endocannabinoid system in detail. And both Les and I feel that it's important that we address THC as the next subject. THC chemically is a very complicated compound. It is found obviously in nature in the cannabis plant, and it is the prototype of a number of chemical compounds called cannabinoids. Cannabinoids all have similar chemical structures, but they interact with body systems in a much different way than THC. As per our discussion with the endocannabinoid system, THC engages two receptor sites, CB1 and CB2. CB1 is in the central nervous system. CB2 is, for the most part, in the periphery, in the immunologic system, and the gut, and a number of other organ systems. THC is the primary mover when it comes to medical effects. And its function really is related to a couple things. One is where these receptors are found within the brain and the other parts of the body, and the affinity or the attraction that the compound engaging CB1 or CB2 has. That's just another name for potency. So Les, with that introduction to the chemical aspects of THC, can you walk us through the pharmacology, the actions of THC that are important for us to understand?
I'll sure try to, Hal, and I'll try to break it down for the audience so that it's fairly digestible and easy to understand. Let's begin by just taking a step back and talking again about the cannabis plant. The cannabis plant is a complex biologic entity that contains over 100 chemically active compounds. Those break down into mainly three categories. One is the cannabinoids, of which THC is the most well-known and most impactful and the topic of our discussion today. But there are many others, and I think in future podcasts, we'll get a chance to discuss them. Probably the second most common and most familiar to the audience would be CBD, but there are others like CBN and CBG and so on. The cannabis plant also hosts chemical compounds known as terpenes and another class known as flavonoids. And those chemical compounds also probably play a role in some of the pharmacologic effects of cannabinoids that are derived from the cannabis plant. And the term that is widely used in the industry is that of the entourage effect. And basically, that speaks to the potential for two chemical compounds, two or more actually, within the cannabis plant to have an effect that would be greater or different or modified than if a single one alone was allowed to provide its pharmacologic activity. So combinations of these chemicals matter, and we are just beginning to scratch the surface in understanding what those interactions are and in what doses and things of that nature. But to come back to THC, THC is what gets you high. THC is the psychoactive component in cannabis. It's the chemical compound that can be not higher than 0.3% to classify as being legal and being hemp-derived. So any concentration greater than 0.3% falls into the regulatory category of THC in cannabis. I think the next thing to talk about is how THC enters the bloodstream. THC, as we've discussed before, is a very fat-soluble, what we call lipophilic compound, and it can enter the bloodstream in a number of ways. The way it enters the bloodstream determines some of its actions and how it affects people in terms of onset of action, how quickly, how intensely, and so on. The most common form of use of THC was probably for many, many decades, inhalation. Smoke a joint, THC reaches your bloodstream very quickly through the lungs. The blood level of THC goes up relatively rapidly. It crosses the blood-brain barrier also very rapidly because of its lipophilic nature. And then it finds those abundance of CB1 receptors in the brain that we talked about, which modulate things like satisfaction, euphoria, well-being, and so on, and produces the high. So when one inhales cannabis, either with a vape or through a cigarette or a pipe or whatever, they will get a relatively rapid rise in THC in their bloodstream. And it will also, unless someone continues to smoke or inhale or consume cannabis in that way, it will also drop off more quickly. So the high is quicker, it's higher, but it's shorter lived without additional dosing. Contrast that to ingestible forms of cannabis. And these are gummies, brownies, all the different ways that cannabis can be ingested. And in that setting, there's a totally different pathway and mechanism for THC to enter the bloodstream because it first has to go through the gastrointestinal tract. The THC is absorbed through the intestinal tract and then passes through the hepatic vein system into the liver. Once in the liver, THC is metabolized. So delta-9 THC becomes a metabolized derivative, which is called 11-hydroxy-THC. Now, why does that matter? Well, it matters in several ways. Number one, where we talked about the onset of the action of THC when inhaled to be relatively rapid, quite the contrary is the case with ingested cannabis because it has to follow this path from the gut to the liver to metabolism to the bloodstream. And that's what's called first pass metabolism. And it matters because it takes time. From the time someone ingests a dose of THC to the time they may feel the effects of it, maybe an hour or two or longer, depending on what else they've eaten and a number of other factors. The other thing to keep in mind, which is also very important, is this active metabolite of THC, which is derived through the liver's metabolism, 11-hydroxy-THC, is significantly more potent than THC. It's 3 to 5 times more potent. So one that ingests 5 milligrams of THC may wind up with a metabolite in their bloodstream that's the effect of 15 to 25 milligrams of THC. The impact, the intoxication, and so on may be more significant. The stories are rampant of people who are somewhat cannabis naive, and particularly with edibles, where they go purchase an edible, take it, hang out for 30 minutes, and think the product was defective or didn't work, and they get impatient, and they take another dose, and they take another dose, and before you know it, they've slept for 2 days because they've had an overdose, if you will, of THC. And again, it's not life-threatening, but it can be an unpleasant experience for one who over-ingests cannabis. So important to understand the differences between smoking THC and ingesting THC.
So Les, I think this is a great spot to talk a little bit about the amount of THC that's listed on products. Oftentimes you'll see milligrams of THC in the flower product, certainly milligrams of THC in the oral products. And you alluded to the fact that THC and the other cannabinoids are lipid or fat-loving. And so when we swallow them and they get into the gut, they're in a water environment and they don't mix well with water. And so the amount of THC that is absorbed and goes through first pass metabolism is much different than what you're going to get with inhalation. The percentage is about twice as much THC is absorbed from the lungs as what you're going to get from the gut. I think that it's important that the audience understands that when you look at these products and you're trying to figure out how much THC is in it, one of the first questions to ask is, how am I going to take this? Am I going to be inhaling it or am I going to be swallowing it?
Yeah, I think it's a great point, Hal, because the route of administration does matter. It matters not only in terms of the concentration that reaches the bloodstream and ultimately the brain, but also the time in which it takes to do so.
So Les, I think you nicely pointed out the fact that inhalation is fairly close to IV accessibility. It gets into the bloodstream almost immediately within 30 seconds or a minute. There are effects with the GI route. It takes much longer to get in, generally an hour to an hour and a half. What about how long these different routes of administration last within the body?
The inhalation route is a higher spike and a shorter duration. And obviously that's predicated on whether one continues to inhale additional doses of cannabis and THC as to how long that duration and effect lasts. But for a single dose of cannabis inhaled, the onset will be relatively quick, but the decline in the effect will also be relatively quick. And that's in contrast to, again, the oral method of consumption where the onset is delayed, but the duration is also prolonged, and it can be hours depending on the dose that was consumed.
How do those two different types of onset and duration affect cannabis as potential medicine?
Well, I think there's a number of effects that need to be considered. One of the things that I think most cannabis physicians have found is that a large portion of their patient population are more elderly. And many of those folks do not have an interest or a desire to consume cannabis in inhalation form. They don't want to smoke a joint or a pipe or vape or whatever. So it leaves ingestibles as the most desirable form of administration for that patient population. So one has to consider, again, the dosing and the duration of action in that patient population. And, you know, as a general rule of thumb, the recommendation is to start low and go slow with how much THC a patient is prescribed and how frequently they use it until one can assess the individual impact. The other factor, CBD does have the potential to be an antagonist to THC. Oftentimes, one will see or find ingestible forms of THC that are blended with some amount of CBD. And one of the reasons to do that is that the CBD may blunt or diminish or reduce the impact of the THC. So ingestible forms, again, the take-home is slower onset of action, longer duration of action, but probably better accepted by a large percentage of the population.
So if you apply that to treating certain clinical conditions, let's just say that we're going to treat chronic pain. Most people with chronic pain awaken with it and they go to sleep with it so that there's a longer action period that's needed than someone who is having a panic attack or someone who needs their medicine immediately available. So what recommendations would you make in terms of treatment of chronic pain, for instance?
Good question. And I don't think that we have an exact answer to where cannabis fits in the overall scheme for management of chronic pain. But certainly there is some evidence and also a more anecdotal belief that cannabis and specifically THC can help control chronic pain and reduce, maybe not eliminate, but reduce the need for other more concerning medications, specifically opioids. So in the management of chronic pain, the idea here is to get a dose where the time of onset, in other words, how quickly it works, is not as important as how long it lasts. So using it in an oral form that will allow for a slower onset but longer duration of action is generally what is recommended. The other point that I would make is that one of the real important advantages of being able to acquire medical cannabis is the regulatory and oversight that goes into its production and sales and distribution. So again, you go down to the street corner and buy a bag of weed from some guy and you have no idea what's in it, what the concentration of THC, what bad things might be in it, and so on. And at least in theory, any cannabis that's sold in a state-sanctioned, regulated dispensary is going to have gone through a level of scrutiny that can give the consumer some peace of mind that it's not contaminated with bad things like pesticides and heavy metals, but also that it has a concentration of THC right on the label that you can believe is accurate, which may matter a lot in terms of the effects that you have from taking that particular product.
Well, thank you, Les. I think this is a good place to stop this part of the discussion. We'll pick it up with our next podcast. As we've tried to do in each of the podcasts, we're going to try to take on a question that's been introduced by one of our listeners. I heard from a listener who is a mature woman who's 70 years old and admitted to using cannabis recreationally when she was in college and recently decided she would try again and had a very bad experience with a vape and basically was over-intoxicated and not happy with the experience that she had. Is there some way to understand that scenario, Les, without just blaming it on age?
There's a number of ways to explain it and which one applies here, but age is one, what we refer to as cannabis naivety, where one is not conditioned to the effects of cannabis, so the first exposure can be more impactful, and also the dose. You know, again, if one is not paying attention, as a general rule of thumb, the THC concentration of pretty much every product that's out there now is dramatically higher than it was 20, 30, 40 years ago. So for a given size joint or a given size pre-rolled cannabis cigarette or whatever, the dose of THC might be dramatically higher than one was used to or expecting, and that can also play a significant role in that kind of reaction.
And I think, alluding to earlier discussion, many of these vape products now are pure THC. They're individual ingredients as opposed to reflective of the flower. As Les mentioned, CBD does act as a break or a governor when it comes to the binding of THC on CB1. And so if you're using pure THC, the high, the intoxication is going to be much greater than if you use a full flower product. So I think all of those things are important to understand when people are choosing product. So with that, Les, we appreciate your expertise and you're willing to share it. We'll see you back here next time.
Thanks, Hal. Enjoyed it. All information, material, and content on this podcast is for general information and educational purposes only and is not intended as a substitute for professional and/or medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment by a qualified physician or healthcare provider. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and any materials linked to this podcast is at the user's own risk. Cannabis House Call does not offer personal health or medical advice. If you have a medical emergency, call your doctor or call 911 immediately.